This is a very observationally oriented conference, and many of you may have found yourselves asking the question, why did I get up so early in the morning to hear a talk about string theory? Well, string theory is one of the greatest intellectual challenges of 20th century and quite probably 21st century physics. And that's enough to get me out of bed in the morning, usually. But that may not be enough for many of you. So I'd like to relate that a bit to the subject of the conference. So here is a cartoon of a collapsing, well, the evolution of a black hole. And time is going up, space sideways. And the rough picture is we have some massive object, a star, say, that collapses and eventually crosses its event horizon, the place where light can no longer escape, and then continues to collapse down into a very tiny region, the size of, well, roughly the so-called Planck scale, where it becomes, well, it gets to an incredibly high density and the known laws of physics break down. So once we get to the center of a black hole, we really don't know what happens. Now this is one of the most profound, well, this I think is the most profound question in black hole physics, what happens at the center. But many of you are used to sort of working out around the horizon and may take the attitude, well, that's interesting, but why should we, well, why is that a pressing question? Well, the answer to this became clear in, well, about 25 years ago with the work of Hawking. And Hawking showed that black holes, in fact, do not just stay well, they don't just gobble things up and then last forever. Black holes actually evaporate. They evaporate and emit an approximately thermal spectrum of radiation. And so eventually they will shrink down, and if you wait long enough, a black hole will disappear in a final explosion. So even though observers of the present day are interested only in what goes on, well, out at perhaps, well, out at the horizon, it may well be that some observer in the future has to face the question of analyzing data from the final explosion of a black hole. And there we will need to know what this physics is at the center of the black hole. Now, this profound question is actually crystallized, it turns out, in a very sharp paradox that has been vexing a number of people in the field ever since Hawking's discovery 25 years ago. And that sharp paradox goes by the name of the black hole information paradox. It's the question of what happens to information that has been thrown into a black hole. So as you've just been told, all the speakers will be handing in their transparencies for scanning on the web. But let's suppose that the person that you hand your transparencies to accidentally falls into a black hole on the way to the scanning machine. And the question is, can the rest of the world know, and is there any way to find out what was on those transparencies? Well, if this were an ordinary physical process, like a nuclear explosion, for example, then the answer to this is yes. Of course, one can know what was on the transparencies. One has to do a lot of work to, well, one can in principle know what was on the transparencies. One has to do a lot of work and carefully measure all of the radiation from the explosion and measure the remaining, you know, the whatever's left. Do extremely careful measurements, and in principle, one can reconstruct what was on those transparencies, although clearly in practice that is a formidable task. Black holes are, well, at least maybe fundamentally different than that. This was what was originally proposed by Hawking when he discovered his radiation. And in fact, because this radiation is basically thermal radiation, even more thermal than the radiation in a nuclear explosion. Hawking was led to propose that, in fact, information is annihilated in black hole formation and evaporation. So that is the first possibility for what happens to your transparencies, that the information is just lost. Now, it turns out that violates quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics says that information is always basically conserved. That's a pretty radical proposal, but that's not enough to object to this proposal. But it turns out further analysis, which I don't really have time to explain, actually leads to the conclusion that energy conservation is violated if you accept this. And it's violated in a rather violent way. People in this room would observe a temperature of order 10 to the 19 GeV. At least that's the conclusion many of us have drawn, if you believe this scenario. So that sounds like it can't be right, and we're led to seek other possibilities. A second possibility is, well, the information on the transparency falls in, and then remains in the center of the black hole, evolves according to whatever physics is going on here, and eventually is revealed when the black hole finally evaporates. Now, it turns out that if that is what you'd like to propose happens to information, then that implies that black holes must leave behind massive remnants, presumably with masses of order of the Planck mass. And in fact, there must be an infinite variety of these remnant states, because you can stuff an arbitrarily large amount of information into a black hole via these types of processes. And so that sounds like a reasonable proposal until you realize that if you have an infinite species of infinite number of species of a certain type of particle, that leads to catastrophic instability. Basically, in any process, you will infinitely pair produce these things in the context of quantum field theory. So that scenario seems to be out as well. And so the only logically remaining possibility is that the information escapes. But of course, if you think about what that means, that looks pretty difficult to understand as well. We all know that nothing really can escape a black hole. Once information is crossed across the horizon, it would have to travel faster than the speed of light to get out. And in the context of a relativistic theory, that is tantamount to, well, that would require violation of locality, and in fact, that's closely connected, presumably, with violation of causality. And that leads to all kinds of paradoxes, as we know. So no matter what you suppose happens to information thrown into a black hole, it appears that you end up with an unacceptable consequence. And this has been the state of affairs for a number of years. But recently, string theory, or I'll tell you about a newer sort of version of that, M-theory, has suggested some very tantalizing hints for the resolution of this problem, although it has not resolved it yet. I'll briefly touch on that, although more details will be given, I presume, in Gary Horowitz's talk this afternoon. So I'm going to review for you some of the basic ideas of string theory for most of my talk. And let's start with what we know in particle physics today, and that is the standard model. The standard model has both the quarks and leptons in its matter sector, and then it has the three forces that we know how to quantize, the electromagnetic, the strong, and the weak. And then outside of the standard model is the force of gravity, which we don't yet know how to quantize, before string theory. The basic picture of string theory is that all of the elementary particles in nature are actually little one-dimensional strings. For example, if you take an up quark, which is one of the constituents of a proton, and you magnify it by a factor of, roughly 20 orders of magnitude, you discover that this is a little one-dimensional piece of string, like a little rubber band, that can vibrate and move through space-time. So that's the basic picture of what string theory is all about. And if we look at, well, we learn something else when we look at interactions. For example, consider one of the very basic interactions in nature, an electron emitting a photon, which serves as the foundation of electromagnetism. If you similarly take that process and magnify it by this 20 orders of magnitude, in fact, that process is described by, in string theory, a process whereby a string comes along and sort of pinches off like this and splits into two. And one of the very nice things about string theory is, let's go back to particle theory. This is a sort of a singular point, in a sense. The world line branches there. And corresponding to that, there are a lot of different things you could do at that point, a lot of different kinds of field theories. But in string theory, this is a nice, smooth surface. And in fact, in a sense, this interaction takes place in no place in particular, depending on how you look at this, how you choose your space-time slicing. The interaction takes place in different places. And the fact that this is a smooth process is a very stringent constraint on the nature of string theory. Okay, so to say a little bit more about how to get out the standard model, let's talk about how you study the basic states of the string. So in order to study the states of the string, we consider an idealized two-dimensional surface known as the world sheet and look at maps of that into space-time. So a point of the string is, in general, mapped to a space-time point, which I'll label by xi. And the equation that governs the motion of the string as it oscillates and wiggles and moves through space-time, the equation governing that motion is this two-dimensional wave equation on this world sheet surface, where box is just the standard, massless wave operator, the Dom version. And actually, it makes sense to just treat the transverse components of the string, or the transverse components of the displacement. There's no sense in which a string theory can move sort of longitudinally, and that can be a non-trivial motion. That's, if you move a string longitudinally, it maps back into itself, so that's a gauge symmetry. So we're just talking about the d minus 2 transverse coordinates of the string if we're working in d space-time dimensions. Okay, now that equation is, of course, very easy to solve, and the general solution looks like this. There's a constant piece, then a piece that's linear in time, no piece linear in sigma because of the periodic boundary conditions going around the world sheet. And then, in general, we have some oscillators, both left and right moving oscillators, with arbitrary coefficients. That's the story at the classical level. At the quantum level, we learn that we have to quantize these coefficients. They behave just like ordinary harmonic oscillators, and they obey the usual commutation relations of harmonic oscillators that look like that. So the string is described by a collection of harmonic oscillators corresponding to the normal modes of oscillation as it moves through space and time. And the states of the string are gotten by looking at the possible states of those oscillators. And of course, those harmonic oscillators will have a common ground state, which will be denoted zero, the vacuum. And actually, that ground state is an eigenstate of this operator, the momentum operator, so it carries a momentum p. And then we can act with these oscillators, with the creation operators, to create the higher excited states of the string. For example, we could act with the first mode oscillator on the left and on the right, or two on the right and one second mode operator on the left, and so on. There's actually a constraint which I'm not going to tell you any more about, that the total oscillator number left and right has to be equal. Okay, so those are the states of the string. And in order to figure out what kinds of particles those might correspond to when we look at things from much larger distances, let's ask ourselves the question, well, what is the mass of those different states? So the mass squared of a given state of the string is actually just given by the ordinary harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian up to a universal constant known as the string mass. This is presumed to be of order 10 to the 19th GeV, the Planck scale, roughly. And us high energy theorists always work, well, string theorists work in units such that that is 1. So that's your unit of mass. And the net mass squared looks like this. This is just the standard harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian that you know and love. And, well, that's not quite all there is to the story, because there's also a, as we know, harmonic oscillators have a zero-point energy, and there are an infinite number of normal modes of the string, infinite number of different kinds of oscillations, and each of those will contribute to that zero-point energy. So we get a zero-point energy that's an infinite sum. And all of this actually has to be carefully regulated and so on. So in fact, well, when you do so, this infinite sum of all the integers from 1 to infinity gets replaced by minus a 12. I won't go into the details, but it makes sense, trust me. Okay, so it gets replaced by minus a 12, and so that's how we know what the mass of the various string states is. The vacuum has no oscillation energy, and so it just has a total, well, they're d minus 2 transverse oscillators, so there's also a factor of d minus 2. So the vacuum has a total mass of minus d minus 2 over 6, which is negative, so this looks like a tachyon. I'll come back to that. Well, we'll see how to get rid of that in a second. The first excited state has a mass given by this formula, which in arbitrary numbers of dimensions, d, could be either positive or negative or 0. And the nicest thing happens when we take that to be 0. In fact, the theory is not consistent if we don't. And taking that to be equal to 0 determines the space-time dimension to be 26. Okay, but if we do that, then we have a nice spectrum of massless particles. We have something that is a graviton state corresponding to the anti-symmetric combination, or sorry, the symmetric combination of the indices I and J. We have an anti-symmetric tensor which is related to certain kinds of axions. And finally, if you take the trace, you get a field called the dilaton. And in string theory, the dilaton actually is directly related to this string coupling constant that tells you the amplitude, the fundamental amplitude for a string to split into two strings, like we talked about on the second slide. Okay, so that's the basic spectrum of states of the bosonic string. And that doesn't look a lot like the particles we see in nature. It's got some of them. And furthermore, there was that tachyonic state, and that looks quite unphysical. But in fact, that problem is cured by going to a supersymmetric theory. Basically, one introduces a supersymmetric string theory by introducing, well, fermionic degrees of freedom. And one way of doing that is to consider, well, fermions on this two-dimensional world sheet of the string. And supersymmetry is just the statement there is a certain kind of supersymmetry between the ordinary oscillator degrees of freedom and the fermionic oscillator degrees of freedom that looks something like this. I won't go into the details of this, but epsilon is a parameter parameterizing the supersymmetry transformation. So it's just a new kind of symmetry. But it leads to some very important modifications of what I've just told you. First of all, the tachyon is gone. It's projected out, and so we've solved that problem. Secondly, the critical dimension is no longer 26 in a supersymmetric theory. It's now 10. That's better, but we're still off. And thirdly, we now have space-time fermions, half-integer spin particles. An example is gotten by acting with a certain kind of spinner operator and then one of these bosonic creation operators I was talking about on the vacuum. And this gives a state known as the gravitino, and that's the superpartner, the fermionic superpartner of the graviton. And then there are various other states that I could talk about but won't. Okay, so these theories have the potential to be consistent now that we've gotten rid of the tachyon. And in fact, when you look at the possibilities, the possible constructions, and carefully examine their consistency, you come up with a statement that there are only five possible string theories that live in 10 dimensions. And these go by the name of the type 2A string, the type 2B string. The difference between those is that one is oriented and one is not. There's an orientation, there's a sense in which there's a right way to go around the world sheet and a wrong way, so to speak. Then there are two kinds of so-called heterotic strings, one with gauge group essentially SO32 and one with exceptional gauge group E8 cross E8. And these are all closed strings, like I've discussed. And then there's one other possibility, namely strings can end. And you can have so-called open strings. You can put charges in, well, a sort of charge on the ends of these. And it turns out you can get, when you look at what's possible in terms of consistency, a gauge group SO32 from these charges. The whole structure is much more tightly constrained than field theory. This is it. There are only five consistent string theories, in essence. And there are many constraints that come from anomalies and various other conditions placed on the theory. And this is very sort of suggestive. We are ending up almost with a unique theory, but we've only got one world that we have to describe, and we've got actually five theories. So we're close, but not quite, to having a unique theory of nature. And that is rather puzzling. That, together with this fact that strings live in still 10 dimensions. So I'd like to talk about the second problem first. And in fact, these extra dimensions are a blessing in disguise. And to see how that comes to be, let's look at the different kinds of particles corresponding to the lightest oscillation modes of a heterotic string. Actually, let me parenthetically comment. We're talking about the lightest oscillation modes because all of the higher oscillation modes have masses comparable to this Planck mass, or this actually more precisely the string scale, which again is of order 10 to the 19 GeV. So from the point of view of low energy physics, those are irrelevant. Okay, so we're interested in these in the massless or almost massless modes. And this is a list of the massless modes of the heterotic string. So as we've seen, there's the graviton, antisymmetric, tensor, and dilaton. And then there are the gauge particles that carry the non-abelian generalizations of electromagnetism. And then each of these has a superpartner. Now, that doesn't look a whole lot like the spectrum of the standard model that I showed you on a few slides back. But actually, there's a very nice way of getting the standard model out of it, and that is, well, here I've drawn sort of a cartoon of our universe, which is supposed to be 3 plus 1 dimensional. But the idea is if you look at our universe, blow up a tiny region of it by this factor of, you know, 20 orders of magnitude, the idea is, in fact, the picture would look more like this. You would have our 3 plus 1 dimensional universe, and then at each point in our universe, you would have some, in principle, well, it could be a very topologically complicated, 6-dimensional space tacked on at each point. And this is known as Kaluza-Klein compactification, the fact that there, well, the idea that there are tiny dimensions of space that are hidden because they're just too small for us to see them. And when one Kaluza-Klein compactifies the string, one has a nice picture, or, well, several, well, nice pictures about how to get out something that looks very much like the standard model with gluons, weak vector bosons, photons, and gravitons. Well, and in particular, the gauge groups SU3 of color for the strong force times SU2 times U1. And furthermore, one can get from the gauginos particles that look like the fermions we see in nature, the quarks, the up and down quark, and the leptons. And in addition, we get a bonus, namely, we are able to explain a long-standing puzzle in particle physics, originally stated as who ordered the muon. Okay, the muon, well, these extra generations are really extra particles we don't really need, but they're there. And string theory explains these as just coming from different states of motion, roughly speaking, of the gauginos on this internal manifold. So we've actually solved one physical problem, one long-standing problem in this process. Okay, so I'd like to tell you a little bit more about this compactification business, and I'll actually describe it in detail in a very simple example where we work on a circle. Now, if we were talking about ordinary quantum mechanics or field theory, we know what happens when we put that on a periodic space. The wave function must be periodic, and that means that the momentum is quantized in units of 1 over the radius of the space, radius r. But in string theory, something else happens. In fact, we see that there can be new types of states, which are called winding states. You can have a string that winds around this compact direction. And those states are labeled by the winding number W. Here we have a winding number of 1, here a winding number of 2, and so on, arbitrary integer. And the winding energy of one of these states is going to be proportional to the length of the string, or in other words, proportional to the winding number, well, basically up to a factor of pi with 2 pi, which I've forgotten. It's the winding number times the radius of the compact dimension. So we have both kinds of states. We have both the Kaluza-Klein momentum states, the quantized momentum states, and the winding states. And so the energy of an arbitrary string state is, well, receives contributions from both of those, the energy squared, and then plus the oscillation energy. And so in string theory, if you look at this formula, you see that there is a remarkable fact that this formula is symmetric under exchange of R and 1 over R. And at the same time, you have to change the identification of momentum to winding and vice versa. And this, well, at this level, I've just explained it in terms of the spectrum of free, non-interacting strings. This had to be checked to see that this actually is a symmetry of the theory, and it does extend to interactions as well. And this symmetry is known as T-duality. So that's actually a very important symmetry of string theory. For one thing, it partially solves the question I put to you earlier of why there are 5 string theories, because if you're careful and look at the consequences of T-duality, you see that T-duality actually maps the type 2A string into the type 2B string, and it maps the two heterotic strings onto one another. So in fact, this symmetry, once we discover this symmetry, we really see that there are only, at the fundamental level, 3 different kinds of string theories, the type 2 strings, the heterotic strings, and the SO32 string. So this is progress towards seeing, well, how the theory of nature is unique, but it's not yet the full answer. And this was the state of affairs roughly before 1995. But with this discovery, one is certainly led to ask the question about whether there could be other relations. Now, before I describe to you some of the other relations between different string theories, let me tell you a little bit more about the consequences of T-duality and introduce D-brains. And these have been very much center stage in the second superstring revolution, although they were discovered much earlier, which has taken place since 1995. So again, we have a symmetry of closed string theories under R goes to 1 over R, an exchange of winding number and momentum. Now let's think about what happens to the spectrum of a string as we take the size of the circle that we compactify on to go to 0. From our point of view, if that size goes to 0, we're losing a dimension, and in terms of the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, that corresponds to the fact that all of those Kaluza-Klein momentum states, which have momenta that go like 1 over r, are going off to infinite energy. They're disappearing from the spectrum. But in string theory, something else happens. There are also the winding states around this internal dimension, and they're coming down to zero energy. Okay, so we're getting a bunch of new light states. And those are interpreted in this dual picture on a circle of radius 1 over r as the momenta states in the dual string theory. Okay, so again, these, for small r, 1 over r is large, and the energy of these momentum states is getting small. So in string theory, a rather miraculous thing happens when you go to short distances on a circle, and this miraculous thing is you recover a new dimension that sort of grows back out of sort of nothing. In string theory, when you try to eliminate a dimension, at least in this picture, one dimension is lost, but one is gained at the same time. So you don't change the apparent dimensionality. But you could ask the question of what happens in the context of the open string. So far I've just described closed strings. So let's consider a picture like this. And an open string ends on, well, has two ends that behave much like point particles. So when you shrink down the radius of the compact dimension, those ends are confined to live in this sort of smaller and smaller dimension. But on the other hand, the string, okay, it doesn't matter whether it's the string, the closed string, or sort of the stuff of the open string away from the ends, it's all the same, it's all string, that is allowed to live in, in the full number of dimensions. The string sees that one dimension is lost and one is gained, but the ends see that simply that one dimension is lost. So we must have a picture like this. The strings can still move in the full dimensionality, but the ends are confined now to live on something with one dimension fewer. Okay. They've lost a dimension that they can move in. And so there's some object that must exist that strings can end on, and that object is called a D-brain, where D stands for Dirichlet. That's the type of boundary conditions imposed in this theory on the world sheet. Okay, so that's what a D-brain is, and actually, well, this makes the most sense in the context of the type 2 string. Okay, so we have this picture, this sequence, where we successively compactify on circles, and the ends live in fewer and fewer dimensions. We go 10 down to 9 and so on. But the string itself still lives in 10 dimensions at each stage. And so if we perform this once, we end up with an 8-brain. 8 because the ends are restricted to live in 9 space-time dimensions. 1 is time, and the remaining 8 are the spatial dimensions of the brain. Then we go down to 7 brains, 6 brains, and so on. and at the same time we flip back and forth between the 2B and 2A strings. So here are some pictures of brains. Again, these are like, you know, sort of sheets of mass or energy that strings can end on. And in fact, we can go all the way down to one-dimensional objects known as D strings, or even zero-dimensional objects known as D particles. The story that I've given you so far is true when the strings are free, when the coupling constant is zero. And in that case, these strings, or these D-brains, are absolutely rigid. But when the coupling constant is not zero, we know we have dynamical gravity, and we know that in the context of in general relativity, there is no such thing as a rigid surface, and in fact, these D-brains will fluctuate and wiggle. So at finite G-string, at finite coupling, these will have a tension which goes like 1 over the, it turns out, a single power of the coupling constant. And in fact, the mass of the D0 brain is 1 over the string coupling constant. Okay, well, let me tell you just a few more things about the dynamics of these D brains. First, consider an open string just sort of floating through space. And as I've already alluded to, well, that can be thought of as a gauge boson, a non-abelian analog of the photon. And that is described, its motion is approximately described by a Lagrangian that is the standard Maxwell Lagrangian. Now let's talk about an open string with its ends confined to a D-brain. Well, here, this will have the same dynamical properties, except now it's confined to live on this lower dimensional D-brain. And so it can only move in the y direction parallel to the D-brain and not in the z direction transverse. And so, in fact, we should describe that by a field which only depends on the directions parallel to the D-brain. Now let's consider the situation where we have two D-brains. And here we can have various kinds of states. We can have a string with both ends on one of the D-brains, or a string with an end on each, and so on. And so we have different fields corresponding to these different states, which we might suggestively label in this fashion, A11, A12, depending on where the ends live. Now let's consider, say, n D-brains, which are coincident. Okay, so we have strings that can end on any possible pair. And the set of fields parametrizing these possible string states are now going to be an n by n matrix. And if you're careful about it and look at what the dynamics of these things is, you find that the Lagrangian, an approximate Lagrangian governing this system is just the non-abelian generalization of the Maxwell Lagrangian, where these things are also matrices and where we take the trace. In other words, the low energy string excitations around a stack of n coincident D brains corresponds to an SUN gauge theory. The special case of n equals 3, again, is the ordinary, it's ordinary QCD or some version of it. Okay, we'll come back to that later, but first let me tell you about some more dualities. So in the type 2B string, there are two kinds of strings. There's the fundamental string and there's the D string. And you might ask yourself, what's the difference between those? Is there any fundamental difference between these? And actually, for this discussion, it's best to work in Planck units where we set Newton's gravitational constant equal to 1 instead of string units. This is the only place I'll do this. And in those units, the mass of the fundamental string is the square root of g of the string coupling constant, and the d string is 1 over the square root of the string coupling constant in math. And this, well, we've played this game before, and just staring at these two masses suggests that perhaps there is a symmetry where we exchange the string coupling constant with 1 over the string coupling constant and exchange the fundamental and Dirichlet string. So this proposed symmetry goes by the name of S-duality, and if it is in fact a symmetry, it's a very new kind of symmetry because it relates a strongly coupled theory to a weakly coupled theory and vice versa. And that is, well, there aren't, well, that is, at least in the context of four-dimensional physics, a very new kind of symmetry. Now, let's think about whether this could possibly be true, and in particular, let's think about what happens when we start out near zero coupling with a D string. So the basic picture is that would be a very heavy object, and then we can change the string coupling constant, which, as I said, you know, it's actually given by a dynamical field, so we can imagine changing the value of this dilaton field to adjust the string coupling constant up to a very large value. And the picture is that the D string would then have, in terms of the dual variables, a mass that goes like the square root of the coupling constant, and would be identified with the dual fundamental string. But you might worry that you can't really trust this reasoning, because while we can talk about the spectrum and the energy levels down at weak coupling, this really relies on pushing things all the way to strong coupling, and we might not really understand the dynamics too well there. So there's a question of whether we can trust this relationship, and the answer is actually yes, basically on the grounds of symmetry. Ordinary symmetries are generated by charges, and those stating that something is a symmetry is the statement that it commutes with the Hamiltonian. Supersymmetries are similarly generated by supercharges, but there's one other relationship, and that is that the square of a supersymmetry charge always gives you the Hamiltonian plus or minus the ordinary charge. So let's think about a state such as a state with a D-brain wound around a compact dimension that that is annihilated by the supercharge. Okay, so this is a supersymmetric state. And if we take the square of this relationship, we get that the expectation value in that state of H plus or minus Q is equal to zero. In other words, the energy of the state, or its mass, in this case, is plus or minus the charge, purely based upon the supersymmetry, well, the properties of supersymmetry. Such a state is known as a BPS state for Bogle, Monney, Prasad, and Summerfield. And BPS states have their masses, well, essentially determined by the supersymmetry algebra and, in fact, protected against corrections to this relation. This is a BPS state, and its energy is fixed once you know its charge. So, in fact, we can trust this reasoning. And, or at least we believe we can trust it, it's passed its first test, and we have argued that the type 2B string is S-dual to the type 2B string. When you pursue this a bit further and look at what is S-dual to the SO32 string, you learn that the heterotic SO32 string is S-dual to it. And now we have actually answered the original question. All string theories are related by symmetries to other string theories. In other words, all string theories are the same. But there's another interesting part to the story. Let's look at the type 2A string, which, as I said, has these D0 brains, these D particles, and actually you can have D particles with an arbitrarily large charge given by N. And let's consider what happens to those states as we take the string coupling to a very large number. So you have this spectrum with all these heavy states, but as you increase the string coupling, well, these are also BPS states, so we can follow their flow, and they all bunch up near zero energy. And this is a very, well, this is the type of spectrum that we have only seen really in one situation in quantum field theory. That's exactly the kind of spectrum that we saw earlier in this talk, where an extra dimension is becoming big, and these are the Kluze-Klein momentum states coming down to zero energy. So this looks just like the Kluze-Klein momentum spectrum on a circle, where the radius is given by the string coupling. So what we are apparently learning is that as you go to strong coupling in the 10-dimensional type 2A string is that you discover an 11th dimension. You have an 11-dimensional theory. And actually, this is kind of a magical dimension. It's the place where sort of the unique maximal supergravity exists. Okay, it can be defined there. And the idea is that the low-energy theory of this, this 11-dimensional system is this supergravity, or the classical theory. But we don't really have a quantum version of that yet beyond the way I've just defined it. And so a name was given for sort of what lies beyond the quantum version of this 11-dimensional theory, and that name is M theory. M standing for magic, mother, mystery, and possibly matrix. Okay, so just to summarize, we have a picture that looks like this. All of the various string theories are connected to one another, can be continuously deformed into one another by compactifying dimensions and deforming the coupling constants. And then on top of all of them sits this mother of all theories, M theory. And in some sense, you should be able to derive all the other string theories from that theory. But there's a lot that we don't know at this point. We don't really know what the fundamental degrees of freedom are. They're probably not strings. It doesn't look like you can really make brains out of strings. Okay. They could be brains, although that's a possibility that's been investigated. But we really don't know what the fundamental degrees of freedom are, and we don't know what the fundamental dynamics is. There's a proposal for this that the fundamental degrees of freedom are actually these D particles, and the dynamics is governed by a matrix theory. But that is, the jury is still, well, in a sense, out on that. That's not the complete picture, although it may be part of the picture. I won't have time to tell you about matrix theory, but I'd like to tell you about something that is very closely connected to it, and that is this new kind of duality recently that everyone has been talking about, the ADS-CFT duality, which was conjectured by Maldacena. So in the remaining few minutes, I'll just give you a rough outline of the ideas behind this. So let's consider N coincident three brains, and as I've argued, the low energy excitations about these correspond to an SUN gauge theory, a non-abelian analog of electromagnetism, with a coupling constant, the Yang-Mills coupling constant given by this relation, and here we're talking about a four-dimensional theory, the dimension we live in, four space-time dimensions, because these brains have three dimensions, and then there's time. Now, in the context of string theory, we have to think about gravity as well, and these things have a mass. The mass of this stack of parallel, well, or coincident D brains is proportional to the number of them. And then there's a 1 over the string coupling constant, and the gravitational field involves an extra power of Newton's constant, which goes like the square of the string coupling. And so the gravitational field looks something like this, at least at the non-relativistic level. Now let's think about what happens as we take the number of D brains to be large. This is actually a time-honored limit in SUN gauge theory. This is a limit that has been used to study the dynamics of that theory. In the context of gravity, that means that these D-brain, well, the stack is getting to be very massive, the gravitational field is getting to be very strong, and in fact, a horizon emerges, and this stack becomes actually a black brain from which light can't escape. It has a horizon. Now, that's sort of a cartoon picture. And let's talk a little bit more about the real geometry underlying this. So if you look at the geometry of that, it looks something like a, well, an apt analogy is a crevasse in a glacier. You have here an asymptotically flat region. That's where you're safe. And then there's this deep, scary slot that you'd better not fall into. And down at the bottom of that is the event horizon. And as you approach the event horizon, this space approaches a particularly simple form. It's anti-de-Sitter space, a space of a constant negative cosmological constant. Actually, this is a 4 plus 1 dimensional space, the 4 coming again from time plus the dimension of the brain, and the 1 coming from the radial direction. And I've argued that this is equivalently described by an SUN gauge theory. So we're led to a rather radical proposal, although it doesn't look radical on the face of it, namely that string theory on this anti-de-Sitter space is dual to SUN gauge theory. And actually, just a word on semantics, there's a lot of supersymmetry that has to come into play for this relationship to hold. And there's actually enough that this SUN gauge theory is actually a conformal field theory. And those of you who don't know what that means, don't worry about it. But that's where the term comes from. Or that's where the name ADS-CFT duality comes from. Okay, so this was Maldacena's conjecture. And in the last couple of minutes, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about what that has to do with the problems I started with. Okay, so the picture is that string theory on anti-de-Sitter space is equivalent to gauge theory from 3 plus 1 dimensions. And that's very interesting because this is a concrete proposal for what are the internal states of, well, in this case, a black brain, but a black brain is very analogous to a black hole. Okay, it's the same type of object. And it seems that we have a nice, hopefully intelligible description of its internal states, if this conjecture is right. This is something that Gary Horowitz will be no doubt telling you more about this afternoon. And there are some other examples of this kind of thing. Now, if we have a quantum mechanical description of the internal states, that also suggests that we should have a resolution of the information paradox at hand. We should really be able to understand what happens to information that falls into a black hole. And in particular, the nature of this correspondence suggests that we may have a particular kind of resolution. This correspondence is what is known as holographic in the sense of Tuft and Susskind. It's very surprising, but we seem to have a correspondence between a 3 plus 1 dimensional theory and a 4 plus 1 dimensional theory. That's a very new type of thing. One way of saying it is all of the physics in this room, and in particular things that take place supposedly at sort of local regions in this room, actually have a more fundamental description in terms of dynamics living on the walls of this room. So that's the idea of holography. And in particular, the number of degrees of freedom in this room or in a given volume is, in a holographic theory, proportional to the surface area, the area of the walls. And that's very suggestive in the context of black holes, if you recall that the Hawking-Bekenstein entropy of a black hole is proportional to its area. Okay, it sort of smells right. Furthermore, as I've said, local physics is at the fundamental level described in this highly non-local way in terms of physics on the boundary of a region. And so, this is a new type of non-locality in physics that we're seemingly being led to. And That was just the kind of thing one needed for one of the explanations of what happens to black hole information to make sense. Namely, the information, this might be an explanation of how the information comes out, though we have not really understood this. Just one other comment. If we have many fewer degrees of freedom than we thought there naively were, that could solve another problem, possibly, the cosmological constant problem, and there have been some ideas along those lines. So this is a has been a very exciting time of exploring these ideas, and we're not really sure what's going to come out of it, but it certainly looks like we have some tantalizing hints. Just to summarize the talk, I've told you that strings can reproduce the standard model of particle physics plus gravity. One of the great successes of string theory is it's, in principle, told us, we believe, how to quantize gravity, or at least perturbatively quantize gravity, and now we've developed all kinds of new non-perturbative techniques. I've told you what the degrees of freedom of string theory are. They're strings and D-brains, although the fundamental degrees of freedom remain unknown, perhaps. I've told you that various dualities show you that all the different string theories are actually limits of an overarching 11-dimensional M theory, whatever that is. And finally, I've told you that string theory on anti-de Sitter space, or actually you can think of M theory on anti-de Sitter space, is equivalent to ordinary lowly Eschewen gauge theory in a correspondence that is holographic and suggestive of a solution of the black hole information problem. Of course, there are some outstanding questions which probably will not be answered in this millennium. One is the question of what is M theory, and another is, bringing it back to the subject of this conference, whether the black hole information paradox is solved. So I'll finish there.
Thank you very much, and now we have time for questions.
Well, general relativity is basically the long distance or low energy limit of string theory. Okay, it's what you get from string theory when you look at things much below this, you know, sort of Planck distance scale. And so, so general relativity in this view is an incomplete theory, which is more completely described by string theory, and then the various string theories are dual to other string theories.
Right in the beginning, when you talked about this information paradox, you gave us three possibilities.
Right.
And then you said information being destroyed must be violated quantum again. That I understood.
Right.
You also said that it leads to non-conservation of energy.
Yes.
Do you think you could explain that in a little bit
more? Yes, the two-sentence explanation. But the explanation is, well, let me give you a sketch of the explanation. Basically, there's a close connection between information and energy. To lose some amount of information in a given amount of time, you have to lose some amount of energy. And so if black holes don't conserve information, at some level they're going to violate energy conservation. Now, why would that not be just some innocuous loss of energy that we only see when there's a macroscopic black hole out there? Well, we know in quantum mechanics that sort of anything that can happen will happen. And in particular, you can have virtual processes involving sort of intermediate states of black holes where information and energy is lost. And these processes can, in principle, take place on all possible distance scales, all the way down to the, well, and perhaps are dominated by the Planck scale. And so if you look at it carefully, you discover that Well, it certainly appears that there is energy non-conservation with energy violations of order of the Planck mass or the Planck energy, and these are happening sort of one per Planck volume, so they're very, very common. And this would be interpreted by an observer at our scale as raising the temperature of this room to the Planck temperature, 10 to the 19 GeV. So that's the basic idea.
Do you expect any of the scalar field to remain massless?
That is a very good question in the context of various current ideas. And the short answer is we really don't know what dynamics, we don't have a complete picture of what dynamics fixes the mass of the scalar fields. It's tied up with supersymmetry breaking and so on, which is believed to require a deeper non-perturbative understanding of the theory. You know, we've got a lot of non-perturbative information, but we don't yet have complete enough information to really answer the question of what happens to the scalar fields and make real predictions.
We have
to possibility.
Gotcha.
Taking off on a phenomenological tangent, would you speculate about the connection between supersymmetric particles and dark matter from this in another context?
Right. Well, there are a number of proposals. Well, a number of proposals for what the dark matter is, and one of the still viable proposals is that the dark matter is one of the superpartners, the lightest superpartner, which would be a stable particle. And so that's nicely encompassed in this whole scheme, because actually string theory reproduces at low energies, not just the standard model, but the standard model together with supersymmetry and the superpartner. So without getting into the details of various schemes, supersymmetric dark matter is certainly a possible prediction of string theory, so to speak.
Thank you very much. I think that we can have